Mark itself. And so what happens is you go off and join the nearest non-profit organization, and you end up exhausted 6 months later because you have not followed your longing to get there. You have not taken on the wound, as Gandhi took on the wound in some ways when he was hit by those sticks in South Africa when he was burning his identity card. That was his taking on of the spear. But what's your longing? Are you doing it because you feel there's something wrong with the world and it needs saving? Or have you followed those salmon out into the sea? Have you gone to the place where the woman and the man embrace to touch the innumerable sea of what continues? Salmon boy swam fastest of all. He leapt out of the water and slapped his blue, green, silvery tail, crying, "Hey, oh, I jump again and again." Oh, he was salmon boy. He could see everything. He could swim everything. He could breathe everything. And then his father speared him. He lay on the dry riverbank with his round eyes open, saying nothing. While his father opened his belly, he said nothing. While his mother opened him up wide to dry in the sun, oh, he was full of the sun. He was full of the sun all day. He dried on sticks, staring upriver. Feel this again and again in the spiritual tradition, that the stakes get higher and the current in some ways gets stronger. And there has to be something real there to sustain you. Abstraction, idealization will not do it. Dogma will not do it. When you get to a certain stage in your spiritual experience, you have to have an equal fire of longing inside you to meet the fire that will also consume you at the same time. So Goethe, in his poem The Holy Longing, Die Selige Sehnsucht, he says, "Sagt es niemand nur den Weisen, weil die Menge gleich verhirnet. Tell a wise person or else keep silent. For those who do not understand will mock it right away. I praise what is truly alive, what longs to be burned to death." In the calm waters of the love nights, where you were begotten, where you have begotten, a strange silence comes over you as you watch the silent candle burning. Now you are no longer caught in the obsession with darkness, and a desire for higher lovemaking sweeps you upward. Distance cannot make you falter. Now, arriving in magic, flying, and finally insane for the light, you are the butterfly and you are gone. And so long as you have not experienced this, to die and so to grow, you are only a troubled guest on the dark earth. Und so lang du das nicht hast, dieses sterb und werde, bist du nur ein trüber Gast auf der dunklen Erde. Tell a wise person or else keep silent, for those who do not understand will mock it right away. I praise what is truly alive, what longs to be burned to death. In the calm waters of love nights, where you were begotten, where you have begotten, a strange silence comes over you as you watch the silent candle burning. Now you are no longer caught in the obsession with darkness. And a desire for higher lovemaking sweeps you upward. A desire for higher lovemaking sweeps you upward. Distance cannot make you falter. Now, arriving in magic, flying, and finally insane for the light, you are the butterfly and you are gone. Gone. And so long as you have not experienced this, to die and so to grow, you are only a troubled guest on the dark earth. Magnificent translation by Robert Bly. When I first read this poem in translation, I thought it was a nursery rhyme until I saw what was uncovered in that translation. So long as you have not experienced this, to die and so to grow, you are only a troubled guest on the dark earth. see again and again the contemplatives and the poets, the storytellers, the myth tellers, they say, you get to this place, things are going to shake. It's almost like an earthquake that you go through. You are going to quake. The quake is now. That's why they were called it. There's a bridge in Oxford actually called the Quaking Bridge, because the Quakers used to meet there and quake together in the presence of God. This upsets other people. You don't like it. A, they don't know what's going on, and B, there's a kind of subconscious reminder of what they're not experiencing themselves in some ways. Scary. Here's Rumi, the great Persian mystic, having a look at that spectrum of entrance, where he says, where you get this wild energy which suddenly comes in at a certain stage of attention to life. He says, he starts off in the black hole stage, because he says, the flute weeps to the pacing drum. The flute weeps to the pacing drum. The drunken camel staggers to his knees and tugs on the rope of reason. This is a strategic mind. The drunken camel staggers to his knees and tugs on the rope of reason. The little bird in the heart's cage is putting out his head on this side and that. The flood fills the ancient riverbed, and once again the riverbanks are green. The falcon hears the royal drum and circles, seeking the wrist of the king. The falcon hears the royal drum and circles, seeking the wrist of the king. The musk deer smells the lion, and her haunches are trembling. The madmen have seen the moon in the windows. They are running to the roofs with ladders. The madmen have seen the moon in the window. They are running to the roofs with ladders. Somewhere tonight a dervish cries, it was my soul in the wine, it was my soul. In many ways, our ways, the way the strategic mind will go into spiritual experience is it will close down and narrow as it goes in. So we go into a spiritual experience, into an opening, by getting as far as possible like this, until we're... Then we said, oh, see, I did it. And then you go... Yeah, that was a real experience I had. Just try and go inside. I said, like, see, Rumi here is doing this as he goes in. Ah. The flute weeps to the pacing drum. The drunken camel. The experience, yes. The drunken camel staggers to his knees and tugs on the rope of reason. The little bird in the heart's cage is putting out his head on this side and that. You know those times? Just put your head out a little bit. The little bird in the heart's cage is putting out his head on this side and that. The flood fills the ancient riverbed, and once again the riverbanks are green. I'm hearing music. Is it? Okay. The falcon hears the royal drum and circles, seeking the wrist of the king. The musk deer smells the lion, and her haunches are trembling. Says, are you ready for this? Because there's going to come a moment where you realize you're going to be eaten. The musk deer smells the lion, and her haunches are trembling. The musk deer smells the lion, and her haunches are trembling. You've got death and sexuality in one image here. It's tremendous. The musk deer smells the lion, and her haunches are trembling. The madmen have seen the moon in the windows. They are running to the roofs with ladders. Can you allow yourself to do that when you see the moon in the window, your equivalent experience? Can you run to the roofs with ladders? This is the crazy wisdom of the East. But can you give expression to it? What's your own way of running to the roofs with ladders? Somewhere tonight, a dervish cries, "It was my soul in the wine. It was my soul. It was my soul in the wine. It was this is my soul." If you asked Rumi about how you do this, and he was asked again and again, I think, by his students, how do you do this? How do you enter? How do you take the sword from the hand? How do you walk through the hedgerow into Tiananmen? How do you find the moment where you just cross over a land not mine? How do you find the secret of secrets inside you again? And Rumi must have grown tired of this because he finally wrote a poem called Say Yes Quickly. If you want to know how to do it, just say yes quickly. So this is his poem. It's a wonderful poem. If you're ever shilly-shallying about something, you just recite this poem to yourself. You say, rise up, say God is great. Rise up, forget your life, say God is great. You think you know what time it is? Well, it's time to pray. You've made so many little figurines, too many. Don't knock on any random door like a beggar. Reach your long arm out to another door beyond the street where you go, the street where everyone asks you, how are you? And no one asks you, how aren't you? Tomorrow you'll see what you've broken and torn tonight, thrashing about in the dark. Tomorrow you'll see what you've broken and torn tonight, thrashing about in the dark. Inside you, there's an artist you do not know about, and she's not interested in how things look different in moonlight. If you are with us unfaithfully, you are causing terrible damage. If you are with us unfaithfully, you are causing terrible damage. If you have opened your love to the great love, you are helping people you have never known and will never see. Is what I say true? Say yes quickly if you know it, if you've known it since before the world began. Rise up, say God is great, forget your life. Forget your life. You think you know what time it is? You think you know what time it is? Well, it's time to pray. You've carved so many little figurines. Every one of us gets a vision of our desk at the moment. With all those piles and projects. You have carved so many little figurines. Too many. Don't knock on any random door like a beggar. Reach your long arm out to another door, beyond the street where you go, the street where everyone asks you, how are you? But no one asks you, how aren't you? Tomorrow, you'll see what you've broken and torn tonight, thrashing about in the dark. Inside you, there's an artist you do not know about. And she is not interested in how things look different in moonlight. Rumi says, if you think this is just a matter of aesthetics, think again. This artist wants something else. Inside you, there's an artist you do not know about, and she is not interested in how things look different in moonlight. If you are with us unfaithfully, you are causing terrible damage. If you don't have faith in your own longings, your own deep desires, your own place, your own way in the world, you are causing terrible damage. If you are with us unfaithfully, you are causing terrible damage. If you have opened your love to the great love, you are helping people you have never known and will never see. Isn't that great? You are helping people you have never known and will never see. We know it's true for some reason. We don't know why we know it's true. You are helping people you have never known and will never see. Is what I say true? Say yes quickly. Yes. 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 It's still not quick enough. Never is. Say yes quickly if you've known it. If you've known it since before the world began.
couple of images of.
Here's one image of Wordsworth saying, yes, quickly. Or it's not an attempt to get to fit a word in between experiences, but the yes is in the experience itself. And here, this is where Wordsworth has followed this injunction of the elder. In many ways, you know, the Romantic poets had to build up their own eldership. They were trying to revive something which had been lost in some ways 1,000 years before in the Druidic oral tradition of direct revelation from the world and of paying very deep attention to it and of having an intuitive capacity for deep emotion to arise because of that attention. So Wordsworth is walking over the hills towards on Midsummer Night, 1788, 18 years old. And he's coming back from a Midsummer Night's fair. And they've been dancing and everything, equivalent of the Maypole, but on Midsummer Night. And in the Lake District at that time of year, because I'm there during this time every year, it doesn't get dark until midnight, really. It's not finally dark until after midnight. Then it gets light again at about 2:30 in the morning. So he's probably walking back sometime 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning over these hills towards Hawkshead. And he's followed, if you read the prelude, you see him as a child following this depth of attention in the world. This going to the place where the woman and the man embrace to touch the innumerable sea of what continues. And here he is, he says, 2 miles I had to go before I reached my home. 2 miles I had to go before I reached my home. Memorable was the morning. Glorious was the morning, a memorable pomp, more glorious than I ever had beheld. The sea was laughing at a distance, all the solid mountains were as bright as clouds, grain tinctured, drenched in empyrean light, while in the meadows and the lower grounds lay all the sweetness of a common dawn, with dews, vapours, and the melody of birds, and labourers going forth into the fields. Ah, dear friend, need I say, but to the brim my heart was full. I made not vows, but vows were then made for me. I made not vows, but vows were then made for me. Bond unknown to me was given that I should be, else sinning greatly, a dedicated spirit, and on I walked in blessedness which even yet remains. 2 miles I had to go before I reached my home. More glorious than I ever had beheld, the sea was laughing at a distance, all the solid mountains were as bright as clouds, grain tinctured, drenched in empyrean light, while in the meadows and the lower grounds lay all the sweetness of a common dawn, with dews, vapours, and the melody of birds, and labourers going forth into the fields. Ah, dear friend, need I say, but to the brim my heart was full. I made not vows, but vows were then made for me. Bond unknown to me was given that I should be, else sinning greatly, a dedicated spirit, and on I walked in blessedness which even yet remains. The attention comes so strong that he hears the vows that the world has made on his behalf. You know, and all of us feel intuitively that vows have been made on our behalf at one time or another. And it's a question of remembering what they were or paying attention enough to hear the world saying them. What vow was made on our behalf? What's the vow that allows the passion to be there the whole time? What's the vow that allows the patience in that passion? We're coming to a grand finale here. The world speaks back, you see. We just need them all to march in through the dark. Pom-poms and... But this happens for each of us. It's not only Wordsworth who has those breakthrough experiences, not only Rumi, they're there for each of us each day, I feel. The difference between a Rumi and a Wordsworth and ourselves is the ability to grant the magnificence of your own experience. And their way of doing it was through speaking it, through saying it, through writing it. Van Gogh's way was through painting it. What's your own way? What's your own expression of bringing out the dance? Where you keep dancing until you sight the deer. And I thought of the tribe whose dances never fail, because they keep dancing until they sight the deer. Because they keep dancing until they sight the deer. There's patience and passion in one line. Because they keep dancing until they sight the deer. So I want to finish up with a couple of poems. One's by Jeremy Reed, a contemporary poet about my age in England. Probably going to be the most famous poet in my generation. And he's a kind of Mozart of poetry. He writes probably about 1,000 poems a year and publishes about 300 of them. And all the other poets in England are dying of green envy. Yes, it's terrible because he's so good too at the same time. It'd be all right if he wrote 300 bad poems. So he's marvelous. Jeremy Reed, R-E-E-D. And here's his own equivalent experience to Wordsworth, but he's in the Shuf Mountains of Syria. It's a short poem. A car breaks down up in the mountains. He sees a flock of goats coming out of a ditch. The sun's going down, the moon's coming up. And he sees a red arrow on a boulder. That's all he needs. And he says, marvelous first lines, because he says, the ancients said that poetry is a dream ladder to God. The ancients said that poetry is a dream ladder to God. My work lacked that directive. See, you pay attention to the outer world, you pay attention inside, you're honest with yourself. My work lacked that directive. The ancients said that poetry is a dream ladder to God. My work lacked that directive, but I knew it that day you spoke through me, restoring my own up there in a flock of summit clouds and goats bursting out of a ditch to crop blackthorn and wiregrass and the opposing faces of sun and moon fused in one mirror. The car had broken down and an arrow of blood on a boulder pointed the way to Aleppo. The car had broken down and an arrow of blood on a boulder pointed the way to Aleppo. See, without the experience of the imaginal world inside you, when your car breaks down up there, the only thing you can say to yourself is, why did I not rent from Hertz instead of that dump next to Damascus Airport? And why do I not have any sandwiches in the car? And the damn Syrians can't even have any decent road signs. You see, it's just a complaint. It's a self-referential loop. When you can pay deep attention, then you get out of the car and you say, the ancients said that poetry is a dream ladder to God. My work lacked that directive, but I knew it that day you spoke through me, restoring my own up there in a flock of summit clouds and goats bursting out of a ditch to crop blackthorn and wiregrass and the opposing faces of sun and moon fused in one mirror. The car had broken down and an arrow of blood on a boulder pointed the way to Aleppo. You just need one red arrow. You don't even need the red arrow. You just need a red blotch on the rock. You don't even need the red blotch. You just need the rock. You see it at the time. It's a marvelous poem because behind this word Aleppo is another Syrian city which is resonating there, which is Damascus. Pointed the way to Aleppo. You don't need to know this for the poem to work, but it's a wonderful kind of extra resonance. Something else happened to someone else on their way to Damascus 2,000 years ago. And an arrow of blood on a boulder pointed the way to Aleppo. This is what I call direct vision. In that, in the vision itself, there is no psychological interpretation of what's going on. If you think of the concrete world and the mythological world, and the task is to bring them together, where the mythological world is the great story of which we're a part, of which we will never know the whole of, but which you must tell. You must be able to tell that story in your life. You must be able to tell the mythological aspects of your life in whatever way it is. And that even might be telling it through silence. And on the other side, you have the concrete details of your life which you can never leave. They're always there. And in some ways, the way we try to bring them together is through psychological language, where we're interpreting from one to the other. This means this because it fits into the mythological this way. The mythological means this way because the concrete fits into it that way. But in direct vision, where you're in first-hand experience, you bring the mythological and the concrete so close together that the spark leaps across. And your soul energy is what's alive in that spark as it leaps across between those two. This is exactly what happens in Wordsworth's poem here. It's what happens in Jeremy Reed's experience and in Wordsworth's experience coming home. You bring them so close together that something leaps across. And in that spark is that secret of secrets, is the memory of what we're trying, of what the passion is for and what the patience is for. For that one spark where the stakes are high and the stakes are your life. And the spark is not there, you can lose everything. You can lose your own life. A life that is not lived. Let me finish with my own experience of this, which took place on the Welsh hills. In some ways it's a good place to finish because it brings round the image of Moses again, which we started with. And it's a poem called The Opening of Eyes. I had this strange experience. I've always been a Celtic scholar, and I've always read all the old Arthurian legends and everything, but I came over this moorland one day, and above the village of Gerland, walking over to go and have a cup of tea with a friend of mine in the next village of Rackham. And usually when you walked over this patch of moorland, there was mist there or something, and sure enough there was this time. There was just a thin veil of mist. But I was astonished to see that there was this bright object kind of floating in the mist. And as I got nearer to it, I saw that it appeared to be a sword. And I couldn't believe it, you know. I knew the difference between the mythological and the concrete. This is ridiculous, you know. It's like lifting my mouth out of the moorland. Open totally. I was totally aghast, and the nearer I got to it, the more it looked like a sword. I mean, I could even see the fretwork along the pommel and this kind of damascene work along the blade. The nearer I got to it, the more I stared at it. And I was absolutely astonished, and it was flat. It was just as if it was being held to me. And then suddenly the mist cleared, and I saw that what it was the sunlight reflecting from the Menai Straits. The sun was going down in the evening. It was reflecting off this thin channel of water between the old sacred island of Anglesey and the mainland, and reflecting like a mirage up into the mist where it was held there. But afterwards I realized, it was both, because which is more a miracle, seeing a sword in the mist or having the light just reflect at that moment exactly as you're walking over to create the picture of a sword? You know, there's both at the same time. Mythologically it's a sword, concrete it's the light. But what's the experience where the spark leaps across? And it was a moment where I was given something and I was asked to take it. You take it. So that point where Wordsworth said, I should be sinning greatly, a dedicated spirit. It's only at that point that the sin comes in, where you turn away from it and say no. You switch half the switches off in your body in order to do it. That day I saw beneath dark clouds the passing light over the water. That day I saw beneath dark clouds the passing light over the water, and I heard the voice of the world speak out. I knew then, as I had before, life is no passing memory of what has been, nor the remaining pages in a great book waiting to be read. That day I saw beneath dark clouds the passing light over the water, and I heard the voice of the world speak out. I knew then, as I had before, life is no passing memory of what has been, nor the remaining pages in a great book waiting to be read. It is the opening of eyes long closed. It is the vision of far-off things seen for the silence they hold. It is the heart after years of secret conversing, speaking out loud in the clear air. It is the heart. It is the heart. It is the heart. After years of secret conversing, speaking out loud in the clear air, it is Moses in the desert, fallen to his knees before the lit bush. It is the man throwing away his shoes as if to enter heaven and finding himself astonished, opened at last, fallen in love with solid ground. It is the man throwing away his shoes as if to enter heaven and finding himself astonished, opened at last, fallen in love with solid ground. It is the man throwing away his shoes as if to enter heaven and finding himself astonished, opened at last, fallen in love with solid ground.
He said, "Why is that man throwing away his shoes, Papa? That man is a bad man. That man is naughty."
And the 4-year-old gets the rules, then. That's the way it's going to be. You do not throw away your shoes. And in that moment, I had this sudden revelation. First of all, I said, "You're right, you do not throw away your shoes, Papa." You have to get the mythological and the concrete right in. And I said, "You wear them and you wear them and you wear them until one day they don't fit you and then you give them away." He said, "Right." And but I suddenly realized that a child can only grow older. You don't throw away your shoes, it's naughty. Child's fated to grow older, but as adults we have the ability and the possibility of growing younger. Only the possibility. That's where I'd like to leave us, with the possibility of growing younger. Thank you very much.